Henaru will be delivering the presentation. She is the has taken Susan Wilczynski's place, I guess. Why don't you self-describe?
Thank you, Sam. You may notice in the program, Dr. Susan Wilczynski was slated to provide this talk. However, she was unable to come to the conference. I've taken on the role in the National Autism Center as the Director of Applied Research and Evidence-Based Practice, and this is week two in my new position. So let's see how well I can provide the findings of the National Standards Project within 10 minutes. So don't fear, I do have a web address for those of you that are interested in more detailed description of the National Standards Project, and I'll be sharing that with you in a little bit. So the National Standards Project was a systematic review of treatment literature for individuals diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders under the age of 22. We intended to provide practitioners, educators, caregivers, parents with some information regarding evidence-based practice for treatment of autism so that they might be able to make informed decisions about treatment. In addition, we were looking to go beyond what other guidelines had provided. Certainly, we started this in about 2007, and some of the guidelines that had been published were a bit outdated. So taking on some of the very active literature, more recent publications. We were also looking to identify where more research was needed and essentially to promote evidence-based practice when it comes to treatment of autism spectrum disorders. So in order to complete a project of this magnitude, there were a number of professionals from a variety of specializations that participated. So not only did we have psychiatrists, psychologists, speech-language pathologists, we had educators, and we also reached out to the larger autism community, consulting with family members and advocates. And all of these professionals made up an expert panel and a conceptual and conceptual reviewers group, and they developed the model that we used to conduct the systematic review, the process from identifying the articles to actually writing up the manuals that we'll talk about in a bit. So the expert panel spent many hours discussing the inclusion and exclusionary criteria for the articles that would be included in the systematic review. The inclusion criteria, pretty straightforward. We were looking at individuals under the age of 22. We were looking for specific diagnoses of the participants to be autism, Asperger's syndrome, or pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified. The treatments that we were looking at in our review were behavioral and educational in nature. So essentially, we were looking at treatments or interventions that could be implemented in a school setting, in a home setting, or in a clinic-based setting. And we only looked at articles that were in peer-reviewed journals. Now, for the exclusion criteria, we excluded biomedical treatments with the exception of curative diets. The reasoning behind that was a number of professionals on our expert panel indicated that school systems and clinic-based agencies were actually expected to implement these curative diets. So you might have an individual come to a school setting with a special lunch, gluten-free, casein-free, whatnot, and teachers and paraprofessionals are actually expected to go along and implement that type of treatment. So we did include the curative diets. We excluded any articles in which the participants had infrequently occurring comorbid conditions. So, for example, major medical conditions or other psychiatric diagnoses that you don't often see with an ASD. And we also excluded articles that included research designs that weren't commonly used. So we looked at group designs and single subject designs. But the rating system that we developed, which you'll see in a moment, was specifically developed to look at variables that you commonly see in the literature. Again, our age group was under 22, and unfortunately, we were unable to look at any non-English journals. So the methodology to identify articles in our systematic review started out with your basic psych info search. So we used a number of different search engines, hand searches. A number of graduate students were great investigators looking for research articles that met our criteria. We also reached out to our expert panelists who provided us with a number of articles to review. And at conferences, we talked to consumers and caregivers and other experts in the field and asked them to provide us with some articles to review. We ended up with 724 articles, and as most of you know, within an article there could be a number of different studies. So we actually ended up evaluating 775 studies in this systematic review. So how were the ratings developed? And this is where the information gets really condensed. So we had trained field reviewers as another group of individuals who were provided with the research articles. And what we did was develop a comprehensive coding manual and provided them with a pilot article in order to obtain an inter-observer agreement of 80%. So I could back up just a second. We had a pilot group of field reviewers. They worked on specific pilot articles, and we developed the coding manual, and we ensured that everyone was maintained at 80% inter-observer agreement. And what the coding manual outlined was it taught the reviewers how to provide ratings on certain components of the article. These were the variables that they were looking at: the quality of the research design, again, single subject or group design, quality of the dependent measure, how the participants were recruited for the study, and to ensure that the diagnosis was rendered autism, PDD, NOS, or Asperger's. And we were also looking to identify and rate whether or not the authors made efforts to establish skill maintenance and generalization. So once each study was provided with a scientific merit rating scale score, and they were all coded, we then had confidence that we could place, that we could assume that the results were meaningful for the ASD population. Then we went on to looking at treatment effects to determine whether or not the treatment effects were beneficial, unknown, ineffective, or adverse. And again, the web address that I'll give you will provide really detailed information about these different categorizations. But if you look, for example, under beneficial treatment effects, a study had to demonstrate with single subject research design a functional relation established and replicated at least two times. So there were very specific criteria for each type of research design for a article to fall into beneficial, unknown, ineffective, or adverse. So given the scientific merit rating scale score and the categorization of the treatment effects, we then came to the treatment classification. And so we have treatments that were divided up into four categories: established, emerging, unestablished, or ineffective. And again, if you look under the established column, it requires that there are several published peer-reviewed studies with a scientific merit rating scale score of a 3, 4, or 5. In terms of treatment effects, they had to have beneficial treatment effects. And so very specific criteria for each one of these categories of treatments and our outcomes. There were 11 established treatments identified, things such as a behavioral package. Under that category, there were over 200 studies that had some sort of behavioral package, so maybe differential reinforcement of other behavior with functional communication training and things of that nature. Majority of the treatments fell into the emerging category, so they had a scientific merit rating of 2 with some beneficial treatment effects or unknown treatment effects. Of the 22, you see augmentative alternative communication devices, exercise, picture exchange communication system, sign instruction, so on. Unestablished treatments, we had 5 falling into this category: academic interventions, auditory integration training, the gluten casein-free diet, and sensory integrative package. Essentially, what we wanted consumers to be able to do is take this research and use it to identify effective treatments that they might want to use with their individual diagnosed with autism. But what we realized also, and what you see in the manuals that we wrote up, is that identifying evidence-based practice is only the beginning to building an effective treatment package for a young person with a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. Professional judgment, values and preferences of families, and the capacity to implement these treatments are also very important. This is the website to go to, nationalautismcenter.org. We actually have three manuals that are available with pretty detailed information. So we wanted this project to be very transparent. So from the very beginning to the very end, all of the information is there. We also have a guidelines written up for educators, too, that's not listed here. So I encourage you, if you're interested, to please go up and download these. Finally, challenges implementing evidence-based practice in the classroom setting. For any of you practitioners out there working with individuals, you know there are a number of challenges out there. Thank you, Dr. Odom. I'll finish now. Thank you.
We are going to have about 7 minutes to for discussion after each of the presentations, and Hannah and I are sharing this presentation. You are really timely. Thank you. I'm going to talk about a parallel set of evidence-based practices that we have developed through the work of the National Professional Development Center on Autism Spectrum Disorders, and there's several presenters from our group here. We're a multi-university site. This our website address is here, and I'll leave this up for just a second in case you want to write it down. But you can also go to Google and just type in National Professional Development Center on Autism Spectrum Disorders. As I said, we're multi-site. We're located at the FPG Child Development Institute, the MIND Institute in California, and the Weissman Center. These are our co-PIs and wonderful staff that work on our project. We differentiated when we began our work on identifying evidence-based practices. We differentiated between comprehensive treatment models and focused intervention practices. With comprehensive treatment models, we're defining as a set of practices organized around a conceptual framework addresses multiple outcomes for kids. So examples are the TEACH program or the LOBUS Institute program, the Early Start Denver model. We instead limited our search to focused intervention practices, which are individual instructional or intervention practices that focus on skills for children. We began our work, again, in parallel to NSP, because some of us were actually working with the National Standards Project at the time as reviewers. When our grant was funded, we needed to sort of move ahead because of the training and instructional nature of the grant. So in 2006, 2007, we began with a review of the literature following some of the search strategies that you heard about previously. We limited our review to 10 years, 97 to 2007. We included experimental studies that use experimental methodology, and we define single case design as experimental methodology. Experimental group designs or quasi experimental designs. The designs had to meet the criteria established by Gersten, Fuchs et al. For group designs or by Horner et al. For single case designs. And I won't go into those criteria at this point. The inclusion criteria were that these studies had to be include participants who were within the school age range or from birth up to 22, that they had to be identified as having autism spectrum disorders or autism. And the intervention had to take place in a school, implemented in a school-like setting. We We just use the criteria of meeting a minimal standard for us to consider a program as a practice of being evidence-based, which is two high-quality randomized experimental designs, group designs, or quasi-experimental designs, and they had to be acceptable studies, again, or five high-quality single-case design studies in which there were studies conducted by at least three research groups and had a minimum number of 20 participants, so that they, or there could be a combined set of studies that with one RCT being a minimum and three single case designs. So if they had at least that combination, they could qualify as evidence-based practice. We reviewed the literature starting with outcomes as our descriptor in autism, and then looking at procedure sections, method sections to examine procedures, and then grouping interventions by procedures. We identified 24 practices that met our minimum criteria, a set of practices, behavioral intervention practices that are familiar to all of you, I'm sure, prompting, delay, time delay, prompting, reinforcement, task analysis. And I'm not going to have time to specifically talk about every one of these, but so I'll just show these and refer you back to our website. A set of practices that would fit under positive behavior support, functional behavior assessment, antecedent-based intervention, response interruption, and so forth. A set of practices that that focus on instruction, discrete trial training, naturalistic intervention, pivotal response training, self-management. Some practices that are that one sees in comprehensive treatment models, visual supports, individual work systems, also video modeling, computer-assisted instruction. Some practices that focused on social outcomes and communication outcomes. For each of these practices, we have developed modules working with the O'Cali Center in Columbus, Ohio. Those models are posted on the O'Cali website as well as can be reached through our website. They include, in some cases, video examples, an analysis of the steps within models, implementation checklists. Last year when Susan Wilczynski and I presented, we talked about the overlap between the two sets of practices, the National Standards Project, National Professional Development Center, and in reviewing our mutual practices, we saw a very almost direct overlap, not completely direct, but just about with some of the discrete behavioral practices that we identified appearing in the behavioral package category. And this table, or a table like this, appears in a chapter that Kara Hume and I wrote that's in the biggest book I've ever seen on autism research, edited by Jerry Dawson and David Amaral and group. I'll refer you just to that chapter. The conclusions we drew were that there are very little differences between the major analyses, which we were pleased with because NSP's review was so much more comprehensive than ours in terms of years. And there were small differences due to procedural variations in how we define practices. And again, the next logical step, we think, is related to training. We use those practices in trainings that we do with teachers and when we work with school systems, TA providers in programs. And we think that the use of those practices lead to high-quality programs for students with autism spectrum disorders. In fact, Ann Cox will in just a minute talk about quality. So I'm going to stop right now. You've heard about two sets of practices that we have called that we think are evidence-based. So I want to invite your comments. We have allotted about, we've gone through this very quickly. We've allotted about 7 minutes for your comments so that we can then move on to the next presentation. We know how timely MFAR is. So there's a microphone up here. So please, if you're brave enough, please come up. We welcome your comments.
I would like to first thank you. Both projects, I think, are valuable to me as a professional clinician. It's valuable to the parents that I serve, but it's also really valuable to me as a researcher and absolutely is moving our field forward, and I really appreciate it. I'd like to know if you're going to keep updating as new research comes out. I hope you say yes.
Hannah, go ahead.
Well, actually, that's my job now. So like I said, this is week two, and I've already started the Lit Search. The National Standards Project will be extending to at-risk, so treatment for at-risk populations, so those youngsters, and then we're also going to be looking at the adult literature in addition to updating the literature that we had done for ages under 22, so that would be from about 2007 until present. So yes, I actually have a number of abstracts with me today that we're looking through.
And we also have started the process of re-reviewing the literature that's changed quite a bit since 2007. We're extending our literature review back. We only had a 10-year slice before. We're increasing that slice to 20 years. We found so many. In the first cut, you know, the first set of researches we've done, we located tons of articles. So, Jim.
So these are both great to hear, and Susan, I've heard you present this before. It's really marvelously interesting. But so you know, we've done all these great systematic reviews. They're so carefully carried out, and then they don't always agree. So I guess I was sort of curious what your thoughts are, for example, the recent Vanderbilt reports that were published in Pediatrics that were supported by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality had a sort of somewhat different take, and sort of how do you reflect on that, and what kind of advice do you give to both parents and researchers and clinicians about that?
Do you want me to start? Yeah. So, I guess that my feeling is that that I was pleased that ours agreed, and that Vanderbilt just got it wrong. No, that's not right. I think these practices are a place to start, and they're one part of determining the types of instruction that are appropriate for students. So the other things that we always talk about when determining what intervention to use is the history of the student, the capacity of the school, the kind of the range of sort of interests that may exist for that student, how they match up with a specific practice. So it's part of a larger problem-solving process and collecting data on the instruction that's actually delivered. So if there are practices that Vanderbilt identified that we didn't, I think that as long as they have a way of monitoring progress for students and that progress is including, I think that's the important part.
I would also add, too, in looking at the Vanderbilt inclusion criteria, what we actually saw was they excluded a number of single-subject research designs because one of the criteria would you have to have 10 participants. So looking at those types of criteria will allow you to understand a little bit better exactly what type of research they were looking at. With the National Standards Project, of course, we took single subject research articles that had fewer. So I think the inclusion and exclusion criteria will also unlock some secrets behind why there might be some disagreement between projects.
Yeah, good point.